Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Kelly Tatum. I have a small Stafford program, Breaking Bad Staffords. I'd say my journey has been a bit of a roller coaster. A lot of good and a lot of navigating kind of through some challenges. It's been great though. I always wanted to show from the time, show and breed from the time I was a very young child. My original goal was American Staffordshire Terriers. I just had always loved them. I knew about Staffordshire Bull Terriers, but they just, it really wasn't a thing on my mind because one, they just, especially, they're not high numbers. They're not here in high numbers at all. Now, much less 10 years ago when I was looking, you know, kind of like looking into this whole thing. But when I finally did have a chance to get my, because I was raised where dogs were not, I did not have access to well-bred dogs. I did not know anyone in any, not even sports venues, not showing. I lived where dogs are property, and that's how people thought about it. So when I finally got to a point where I could get my first well-bred dog, I was looking into the breeds again, even though I knew Amstaffs were what I wanted. And then there's just something about the Staffordshire Bull Terrier that just really drew me in, just because they just seemed so, it's like almost the same, you know, almost the same, but just a smaller version. And it was intriguing to me. But trying to find a breeder, I'm sorry, I have a litter of puppies that are 8 weeks old. And if you can hear them, I apologize.
Yeah, no worries. It's a dog podcast. So that's the way it should be.
They're 8 weeks old, and they're, man, velociraptors right now.
Okay, that's fine with me. No worries.
Okay. But yeah, so trying to find a breeder without knowing breeders is very difficult. And I had even gone to shows before. I can get pretty shy, and it's hard for me to approach people. But the show world does tend to be, they cannot be as welcoming to new people as you would think. I went to a Amstaff National where I was completely snubbed, and maybe it wasn't on purpose at all, but I didn't have a good experience. So you just get nervous after that. But of course, now that we had the internet at our fingertips, it was a lot of research and just looking into different breeders. I did talk to a few, in the U.S., and it seemed like they had very overwhelming when I tell them I want to show, this is my childhood dream. And you know, I intend to follow through with everything that I say I'm going to do. And it was a bit of a struggle for me. So And another thing about Staffordshire Bull Terriers is we have a very limited amount of breeders here, but overseas, they're everywhere. I mean, if you watch Crufts or Westminster, the difference in entries for the Staffordshire Bull Terrier is crazy. Westminster might have 10 Staffordshire Bull Terriers, but Crufts, you have 300 to 400 entries of Staffordshire Bull Terriers. So honestly, it's you have a lot more options that way. So I came across a breeder on Facebook, and Days of Stafford, his name is Rafa Salado, and he had I had watched him for a short time, and he had a puppy that I was so drawn to, because he looked like one of my dogs that had passed away, and that's possibly silly, but it was just one of those things that spoke to my heart. And so I reached out to him and kind of told him what I was looking for. And again, I'm a total newbie to it. Still hadn't learned pedigrees, hadn't learned much, but I'm in it. So I import him. I got him in 2018, in my first. But even then, I was still I still struggled with trying to get into the show world, because again, not knowing anybody. And at that time, I didn't know that there were handling classes. So I had him for 2 years before I actually went to my first handling class. And once I did that, it kind of took off. I went to a class. The teacher, the handler there was very helpful. And before I knew it, I was taking off to Alabama for my first show. I'm in Texas, so taking off to Alabama for my first show, and it was great. I won a couple of ribbons, didn't get any points, but honestly, I was just super happy for the experience. I got a bunch of help from the people there this time. It was very great. I came back just so ecstatic because people were just very, very welcoming to me at that point. And then I kind of took off. I didn't do any sports at that point. I was kind of focusing on confirmation because that was my main goal, is to one, get into the world, learn, and kind of try to work on a program, building my own program. But it just takes a long while to learn pedigrees, learn how to, I guess, learn how to show, and then how to get to a point where you breed, but not just breed to improve on the breed. So it took me about 4 months to finish him. I was actually pretty quick. We're very, very lucky that in Staffords, we can owner handle them. I know that there are many breeds that cannot be. I know AKC is so very competitive, very difficult, very rigid. But luckily, this is a breed that you can own, and you can take him and show him, and you can finish him yourself. I my first show was in November, and I got his champion. I finished his championship in March, so it took me 4 or so months to finish his championship.
Talk about how difficult, just probably being. Not a type of person that would likes the limelight like myself, but what were some of the things that just drove you to be able to do that? Drive from Texas to Alabama, that to me takes a lot of gumption and motivation
for
to
me,
do that.
Oh my goodness. For me, it was one probably, and I know To some, they're probably not. But for me, it was probably one of the craziest things I've done next to importing a dog, which I had never done that before either. But just, it was just kind of one of those, like, because I'm not a natural extrovert. But I want, this is something that, like I said, I wanted to do. The motivation had always been there. So it was kind of like I was like, I'm doing this. If I had to push myself, to do it, then I will. So I kind of went, it was kind of like one of those, like, I'm going all out. I'm just, this show, because numbers aren't very big, I was able to find a Facebook page where it's called Where are the Majors. And so I was able to find out where a lot of the other Stafford people were going. Because most shows, there's not a big numbers. It's just like anywhere from 3 to 10 Staffords, is kind of average. But this show in particular, I think, had like 20 or 25, something like that. And a lot of well-known breeders are there. So I thought this would be the perfect chance, perfect opportunity. And there had been people that said that they would help me, kind of help me, guide me to where I need to go. Because again, I've never been in that show environment, and AKC being super, super rigid, it was definitely nerve-wracking for sure. But I was just at the point where I'm going to force myself to do it. I was like, I'm gonna greet everybody there, like all the breeders there. I wanted to personally come up and meet them, and just try to make connection with them, and try to find a mentor. Honestly, I don't want to say that I have a mentor. For a while I had one, and then as soon as she was okay to mentor me, she got out of the breed, so that made it kind of difficult. I did end up meeting someone at that show who did become, she kind of still is my mentor. She's more of a moral support. She's there to kind of like cheer me on. But just when I got up there, people did help me out, and it was a great experience. I learned a lot. I learned a lot. I got to go out to eat. I was invited to go out to eat with people, and mainly I just sat back and listened. And by doing that, I think just by watching and listening, you learn so much. Especially when you don't know anything. But I got a lot of tips and a lot of help. My import, he did well. But I do feel like his type is not really what the judges in like to really see here. And this is all stuff that I learned later. He did finish quickly. But he wouldn't be a male that I can take to, high-end shows, Montgomery or Westminster, but he was a good dog to start with. He was a great dog to start with, and just to have fun doing, which is kind of really the goal at that point. I knew that I wanted a program, but it's kind of you baby steps first, learning the ropes first. Because at that point, in my mind, I cannot breed a dog unless I prove that it's breed worthy. Not only showing confirmation, but temperament. I did want to get into sports as well, but confirmation was still my primary goal.
Talk about your first experiences looking for that show quality, breed quality Staffordshire, and what led you to just decide to maybe that importing was the way to go. I know you kind of touched upon it, but just elaborate a little more maybe.
So, again, being naive, not really knowing how to go about with the process. For me at that time, I just I wanted to make sure that one, they were legit, because when you look overseas, there's a little bit of, there's a little bit of fear that you can get scammed or you're going to get the worst of the worst. That's very common to hear, is that people that in importing, you're at risk of getting basically the worst of the litter. I've joined a bunch of groups. And like I said, most of our breeders are overseas. So there's a lot, so I follow a lot of them, and then just coming across that breeder, and you can see clearly in his, what his accomplishments, what he's done with his dogs. And to finish a championship on a dog in Spain is very difficult. It is a feat to do. It is easier to finish a dog here than it is in Spain. They have to beat a lot more dogs than we have to here. There are certain shows, like here, we need 15 points, and two of those, you have to have two majors, which basically means you have to beat a certain amount of dogs. And for Texas, I think you need to beat like five dogs for a major, but over there you have to be like 100. That's just kind of like an example. It varies across different countries. Anyway, so the fact that he had finished champion dog showed me that that dog has been under quite a few judges and obviously has enough virtues to champion. And I'm not even going to go into the politics, because that's just a whole nother story. Some people feel that sometimes the dogs aren't awarded based on virtue, but to me, going out and showing the dog under the judge does speak volumes for, how well the dog does in the ring. And that's what I was going off of when I was looking to get a puppy to show. And of course, I talked to the breeder saying what I wanted, and the pictures I saw of him, he was stacked up, so you could see. He showed me his bite. He sent me videos. I did get to see his structure. So that helped. But yeah, that's kind of why I ended up deciding to go. And one thing about buying. One thing I didn't know was kind of an advantage. It's an advantage is that like you getting from a breeder here often comes with a lot of restrictions, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing, because I do the same thing with my own dogs. I really with my own puppies that I send out, I do have restrictions, but there is a sense of relief getting a dog that is yours. And for me, I trust myself with a dog that I'm not going to, I'm not going to become like a backyard breeder and I'm not, I know that I'm going to go through with what I said I was going to do. I was going to show the dog, I was going to do the health testing, do some sports. He is at this time my most titled dog, and he's grand championed. He has a fast cat title. We've been kind of dabbling in barn hunt. He's done coursing. He's got a title in that. Trick dog, just different things. But there's just a freedom that you have when you own the dog outright. Since then, I've gotten several dogs from breeders over. Breeders here, and I feel like having that first dog, importing that first dog, and showing other breeders that I am going to shows, I am trying to do, I trying to better the breed, trying to do the best I can, if my own program, I think it's good to show them that you are serious about your commitment to the breed, because this community is here is very small and very, very protective. very protective of their breed. You won't really see any Staffordshire Bull Terriers in any shelters here or rescues because our breed club is very quick to get them out. And they want to keep it that way. And I totally get that. I totally understand that. So they're very protective about who they want to give breeding rights to. And I'm the same with my own puppies. I don't give out breeding rights to anybody unless they kind of want to get into the show, into showing. But other than that, they're on spay neuter contracts and the whole deal. Many are many of our breeders do have. We do have a lot of breeders who import themselves as well. I think doing it as your first dog is probably like it's a risk. It is a risk, especially if you're not too familiar with pedigrees, which at the time I really wasn't. I do think I got lucky. But yeah, it's a lot on this subject for sure. And then we do have a lot who will import, who will bring in semen to breed. That happens quite a bit, I guess, to bring in the, you know, genetic diversity and the fact that, like I said, there are so many overseas, so many nice Staffords overseas. And to bring that over here, I think is very helpful.
Talk about the process. What, because to me, it's something that I would like to do someday, especially when you're dealing with breeds that I'm interested in, like mini Bull Terriers and Staffordshire Bull Terriers, because there just isn't the numbers over here like there is overseas. Talk about the process. Just kind of give people insight what it was like and how you had to go through each step and what a learning curve that was, and just kind of the ins and outs of importing.
Yeah, so I've imported, three times now, the first time, with my first, it was a lot easier, but it was also back in 2018. They didn't require a broker, like they do now. And honestly, the breeder did most of the work. He pretty much arranged everything. You know, I paid, I paid the airline directly, which for me, never having bought a dog, never having imported and hearing horror stories about people, even the bank was like, are you sure? I paid the airline directly. So that did help. And then, he basically kind of let me know what to do. So that was a totally different experience than what it is now. I just recently imported a bitch from Ukraine, brought her in with her brother. And again, the breeder kind of does most of the work, but you have to have a broker now. So once you contact the broker, I just posted on pages asking for recommendations, and I found someone. I think you can just Google it and find someone as well. But once you contact them, they get all the information they need from you, and then they and the breeder do most of the work. It is an extra cost to have a broker. Quite a bit. But honestly, it's worth it because they do most of the work. They kind of just arrange everything for you. So, and this time I didn't pay. I paid the breeder directly. And then I paid the broker as soon as it was done. Established. Basically, they do more of the work. I've never sent a puppy off farther than Canada. So as far as that part of the progress I have, or that part of the, yeah, of the progress, I really don't know how it works. But it's just you basically you pay whoever needs to be paid, and they tell you where to go and what to do and what information to give. It's actually pretty easy that way. There's really no like filling out paperwork or, signing on to this. It's simple. The biggest thing. That's why I like to get recommendations. This is why I'll never get rid of Facebook, because that's where I find my handling classes. That's where I found my breeder. That's where I found my mentor. That's where I found my broker. I feel like talking to people, and who give you references, they have dealt with them. They have dealt with them, so they know who to trust. And I think, yeah, that is a big deal. Well, I guess there's kind of two worries. Is importing dogs in the summer is it's worrisome. There's a danger of them overheating because they keep them in car. Some keep them in cargo. Some will get a nanny, which I think is the safest option when you're using, or when you're coming from quite a distance, and when you're doing it during the warmer months. I think there's restrictions now. I think there are certain months that they don't fly puppies in. But so that's a concern, because they keep, like I said, they keep them in cargo, and then when you get there, you're pretty much waiting a really, really long time. But and then you have to pay a gate fee. So really, there's a lot of fees involved. But I've actually found that with Staffords, it costs me the exact same amount to import a Stafford than it does to buy one in the United States. Because Staffords overseas tend to be cheaper, because I'm assuming because they are such high numbers, there are plenty of breeders. They're just not as expensive. But then by the time you pay everything else, it ends up being the same.
Have you ever thought about being your own flight nanny? Would
So
that save any money?
I do fly my own puppies. My pup okay, most I give people options when I have puppies. I give people the option. They can fly in if they want. I'll meet them at the airport, or if they want to fly in and come to me or meet, I would do that as well. Ground transport, I've offered that because I have someone that I know and I trust. But most people they like me to fly them. I used a nanny one time, and I just thought that it was very expensive, and Stafford puppies aren't cheap. And I think my puppies are pretty much average, or even on the lower side of average. But I just it's a lot for people to pay for a puppy and then a nanny on top of that. So I do try to help out with that. And also, I enjoy flying. So I fly my own puppies. I think I've done it maybe 15, 14, 15 times now, and I think I've only had one or two hiccups, but pretty much it's gone smoothly for me.
Would you ever fly overseas to pick up a puppy for yourself or?
Colt, my first breeder, had actually talked to me about that, but I might if I ever got comfortable enough doing it, but at this point, probably not. No, I might look into it later, but I actually don't get many or any. I think I've gotten one inquiry from overseas, and I just was not ready to even attempt that. So no. But again, I don't think I'll be getting more as many inquiries, because there are just so many breeders overseas in all countries to choose from. So And I'm just a small-time breeder in Houston, Texas, who's just kind of navigating my way. I want to say the puppy's more comfortable, but Staffordshire puppies are, they just, I've never known a Staffordshire puppy to mourn its brothers or sisters, to mourn even me as the breeder. Staffordshire puppies are so just, they just go with it. They're just like, they go to their new home and there is literally like no adjustment period. They're just, it was like they've always been there. Every Staffordshire puppy that I have placed, that's what I hear. They're just like, they act completely normal. They're not scared. They are not timid. They do not hide. They get in there and they are just on. They're on every time. And I think that's just a breed trait. I don't think it has anything to do with how I raise them, though I do, you know, I do a lot of, you know, I do ENS and puppy culture and all the things, you know, socializing. But I just think it's a breed. I think it's a breed trait. I thought I knew what I was getting into. I mean, of course, there's a little bit of worry about importing and all that, but I thought because I had had, you know, before that, I didn't know the difference between good and bad breeders, because, of course, I didn't know anybody, so I had ended up with kind of backyard bred pit bulls, Amstaff, whatever they were. So I dealt with bully breeds, you know. I thought, I can do this, because, I mean, they're what? They're essentially the same, you know, that's what I thought. But in reality, they definitely have their own nuances, Staffordshire Bull Terriers. One, I find that they are, they have a lot more energy. They are more high, they're just, I don't want to say high strung, they're just very active and just need a very active lifestyle. And I think that surprises a lot of people. And in addition to that, they are also very soft. They are very soft-tempered. They do not do well with a head. Like, they do not do well in, like, being raised in a heavy, like, any heavy-handed training, any environment where there's a lot of conflict or loud noise. Like, I don't want to say loud noises, but negativity. They're soft. So that was kind of a surprise to me. Like, I never would have said that dogs before that. I'm like, dogs are dogs. Dogs don't pout. Dogs don't hold grudges. And that, no. Staffords pout and Staffords hold grudges. They're incredibly, they read the room really, really well. If you're upset, they feel it. They feel it. If you're mad, they feel it. Sometimes to the point where they will leave the room. Like, they don't want, you know, they're remove themselves from that. I don't train, like, I do positive reinforcement with training. But I have seen, you know, I have seen them being handled, like, say on, like a choke chain, where when you correct them, it's mainly the noise, you know, you kind of jerk the leash so the chain makes a noise, it tightens up and releases. You don't do that to a Stafford. They will flatten out like a pancake. So they're just overall soft. It's actually very well known in the community that they are soft tempered. They will break down at any type of heavy handed training. They just fall apart. But they're so eager to, like, please, they are so Velcro, like, they want to make you happy. And I guess that's not really too different from any other bully breed, to be honest. But it's very extreme. It's very extreme. The neediness is pretty extreme, but I think it's great because, one, they don't really run off. Like, they're not big wanderers. They like to be with their family. And I'm not saying that that goes for every, there's nuances in every breed, you know. I'm sure there's labs out there that don't swim, basically. But yeah, they'd like to be right there with their family. And even other bully breeds, I know, like in Amstaffs and any other bully breeds, where they talk about, like, when it comes to children, how they have, you know, they love children. Well, this it is like it is 100 times true with Staffords. Staffords and children, they just go they go together like cookies and milk. I can be at a show and I'll have my Staffords, and you know, people walk by all the time, especially adults. And my dogs are kind of like, yeah, okay. But if a kid walks by, they will track them. They will track them, tail wagging, like, please, like they want this kid. They want this kid to come say hi. Like, they are desperate to be loved by this kid. They just have such an affinity for children, and it's innate. And it's very, I've never seen it so pronounced before than I have since having Staffords. Yeah, I do have one. I have an Amstaff. I have one Amstaff. I kind of got her as a ode to my original goal of wanting an Amstaff, and the difference is night and day. To be honest, I mean, there are certain similarities, but my Amstaff is definitely more spicy, hard headed. She doesn't quite listen as well as the other ones. And her breeder tells me it's like completely normal for an Amstaff. And like I said, I had had bully breeds before, but never well-bred ones. So like, I kind of thought I knew what to expect. I also find that Staffords don't have as much dog aggression. That being said, I would never say, you know, it's there. You know, it's there, but I would never, you know, not keep that in mind when having my Staffords out together, especially the same sexes. But it just, they don't seem as hot in my experience. And I've had up to 9 here, so I feel like I've had a good enough experience to kind of get an idea of that. And I've also heard other Stafford breeders say that as well with their dogs. But I think those are the, you know, the main nuances that I can think of. My program will mainly be Staffordshire Bull Terriers. My Amstaff is a gorgeous bitch. The breeder says one of the nicest that she's ever bred. I'm just essentially going to do what she wants. I don't think I'm going to have my own program. If I do, it will be a very, very, very small part, because my Stafford program has, it's kind of extensive. It has a couple different directions that I'm going into, So it takes a lot, of me. It just takes a lot. That's all I focus on, but it's a lot for me. So my Amstaff program is just going to be tiny, if anything. But yeah, she will get bred once she's done showing and campaigning.
Can you talk about the breeding process with Staffordshire Bull Terriers? There's anything that surprised you? Anything that people should be aware of when they first start getting into the breed?
Well, I think the most important thing about getting into the breed is just, I guess regarding breeding, not honestly, this was because I had never bred before. I don't know if there's many nuances regarding breeding compared to other breeds. I do know that they have a higher tendency to have difficulties in labor, even compared to Amstaffs. Amstaffs are they tend to be free whelpers and have big litters. Staffords don't have big litters. I mean, it's like 3 to 6 is average. But it can go wrong. And I think that's pretty normal for a lot of other bully breeds. Probably, I'm assuming, you know, any breed that has the big shoulders, because I feel like if you look at a Staffordshire Bull Terrier, like compared to an Amstaff, they are so much more front heavy in the shoulders, and naturally that kind of translate into having issues giving birth. I do have a girl that I have had to have a, you know, C-section on, and once she had that, I was never going to let her free whelp after that because of that. But yeah, just the higher rate of C-sections than most breeds. They make great moms. I think I've heard that a lot of people think that they don't. But I think they might have got them confused with bull terriers. I think someone released an article recently where they talked about how Staffords have a tendency to eat their puppies. That's not correct. I think that they were talking about bull terriers and may have got them mixed up, but our whole community was like kind of reeling after that. Like, no, Staffords make great moms. I'm not saying there are no issues with mothering instincts at times, but Staffords are fantastic mothers. They do a great job. They are very protective of their puppies. They're very, just very sacrificing moms. Well, there is a nuance about them that I just thought, oh yes, because they are really heavy. Staffords are heavy. They're clumsy. They literally have no sense of self-preservation. They do have a tendency to, not be very careful about how they lay down. I have a whelp box with pig rails and everything, but that first week to 2 weeks is just, I have to be there at all times because they tend to lay down and not feel their puppies. They're so heavy for being so small. So I know that that is a thing. That's something to watch out for if, you know, someone wants to look into breeding Staffordshire Bull Terriers. I went through years, I mean years, of trying to find my way, of trying to find a direction that was right for me. Not really having like one mentor kind of didn't help. So what I did is I talked to a lot of breeders and to try to get like an idea of how they run their program, what they thought was, what they thought about the standard, what they were breeding, and got a lot of really, really good insight. But as far as like, and a lot of them were just like, find your type, and, you know, make sure it adheres to the standard, and then, you know, go from there. But I still struggled. Some breeders don't like to talk about the type difference, but there really is. So there's something to be said about our standard. Apparently not all breeds have, or like breed standards have, both weight and height requirements. Usually they'll have just one or the other. So if you look at our standard, 4 feet, so height is 14 to 16 inches, and then weight, like for females is 24 to 34, males is 28 to 38. So that means what I was taught, that means a 14 inch female should be 24 pounds. A 14 inch male should be 28 pounds. Well, you're not going to find that. You're not going to find that in the ring. You just aren't. A 16 inch male, a 16 inch 38 pound male, you are not going to find that being championed in the ring. Like my first, he's 16 and a half inches. He's a half inch over. He is a little over 38 pounds. So technically, he is the proportion they're supposed to be, but when he's in the ring, he tends to be a lot lighter substance-wise than most that you see in the ring. So that has also been a huge, huge struggle of mine, because what they're saying in the standard is not really what's being It's not really what you see in the breed ring at all. We see a lot of dogs with that are within the height range, but they have a lot more bone and substance, and so that naturally they're heavier. They don't re they're they surpass the weight requirements. And honestly, that is, and after years of kind of trying to figure out where I want to go, that's the look that I like. That I do like a not a completely bully Stafford. I like because they're supposed to be a nice blend of terrier, you know, bull and terrier, not really swinging one way or the other. But there's no clear definition, really. There's no like it's you kind of. Kind of up to the breeder to where they want to go on that. And then to make it more difficult is when you go to breed, you might have throwback. I don't want to say throwback, so you might have some puppies that are like terrier, more terrier, and some that are more bulldog. And it's like, well, no, you want what you were aiming for was something right in the middle. And I think a lot of that difficulty obviously has a lot to do with the fact that they are developed from two totally different types of dogs. I mean, if you take a terrier and a bulldog who are completely different and you slap them together and you start breeding from that, it's going to take a long time to get to a point where we are breeding more consistently, the same type. So I do like Staffords within the height range, but they tend to be a little heavier than what the standard calls for. And just that's just kind of how it's been. Our standard does say proportion is very important. I think that that's more we put more emphasis on proportion being more important than actually following the exact guidelines of the height and weight, because we have 18-inch Staffords who are winning groups, but they're proportional. They're nice. They're structurally, you know, sound. So that is more important than follow, you know, than this, because we don't wicket our dog. This breed does not get checked in the ring as far as height restrictions.
Since you've imported, you might have a little insight on this. What are the differences in kind of say your FCI dog and your AKC dog? What is winning in the ring overseas compared to what's winning in the United States? You kind of touched upon the United States, but what's the difference overseas?
So we actually get for our many of some of our specialties, but our nationals, we have foreign judges come over, which is a great opportunity to get, you know, our dogs under them. But I have found that dogs overseas don't seem to be as beefy and bully as the dogs over here. They do tend to be leggier. They I don't want to say terrier because most of them have pretty nice heads. When I say terrier head, I'm talking about very slim muzzles. You know, not we have our standard calls for, you know, sufficient cheeks. But in a very terrier staff, we have some staffers that just have that very kind of wedged terrier head. But as far as like the body goes, they don't have the substance that we have here. And I honestly don't even know if that's beneficial or not, because there's some people that say, you know, how if you consider what these dogs were meant to do, how can a dog who is, you know, short and has all this bone and substance, how would they survive in a ring? How would they move around and be able to fight in the ring? And then you have others who say, you know, well, look at the dog that has all legs. Their legs are going to snap. You know, I've heard both sides of this, and it's just like, where do I go? I need a middle ground here because, you know, I don't know what is right. Because if you look at the dogs, the Staffords from like the 70s, they were pretty substantial and leggy, and they didn't have like we had. I call it like the heads that we have on our Staffords these days. They're so very modern. Their muzzles are real full. They're kind of short, and we have a lot of top skull. But if you look at dogs, even from early on, in development, even up to like around the 70s, we didn't have a lot of top skull at all. It was kind of similar to like the similar to ABDA style American Pit Bull Terriers. It's just not a whole lot of stop, not a whole lot of top skull. It's kind of very flat. And I couldn't even tell you which one was more correct because you can say, oh, well, the original dogs had this type head, but look at the dogs that are winning today. And it still fits the standard though. So that's kind of the struggle there. But I do find the dogs overseas, they tend to have the nice modern heads, but their bodies kind of tend to be more terriery.
Some of the what does health testing mean to your program?
Health, yeah. It's fair. I would say, oh, it's kind of cut and dry, really. Here, I was watching one of your podcasts with the American Bullies, and how that's been kind of a struggle. I guess breeders coming up and kind of wanting to learn how to health test, and luckily, our like our parent club. You can go to our parent site and it'll list everything that you need, and I don't, it's pretty extensive. You have your typical OFA hips and elbows. I like to do pin hip. I do like the measurements. I think we're getting to a point where people want to push doing both OFA hips and pin hip, because not only so it's like it's kind of like you have your measurements here, so you're looking at the laxity and looseness, and then you have your OFA and your OFA view, and they're kind of looking at how the ball joints fit into the socket. So you just kind of get a bigger picture. And then patellas, of course, the genetic panel. We do hereditary cataracts, which is a part of the genetic panel, but we're also supposed to get the eyes checked every year, along with and then we have to get the heart checked. Patellas was listed as optional, but I think we have changed it now to required in order to get the full health testing. But I would say that's pretty cut and dry. I am not one that will, because there are some people out there that will completely eliminate a dog for having like mild hips, eliminate a dog from a breeding program. I have different views on that. We have a lot of controversy because, like I said, our breed community is so very protective of our breed. But from what everything I have read and seen, like if you have a dog that has mild hips, but they, I mean, their pin hip results might be, average or maybe a little better than average. And, they're bred to a dog that has great hips. You can get dogs that have fantastic hips. And actually that has happened to me. Colts, my first Stafford's hips went, mild. I did have an issue with the vet. I got them redone. They came back as fair, but that's still pretty poor. And this was kind of before I knew, kind of, I wasn't as experienced, oh, and I didn't know what I knew now. So I had talked to some people in the community, and I was like, I guess I'm gonna have to scratch him from my program. And I was devastated. I was like, I'm gonna have to start over, basically. And I had some people who were like, wait, whoa, whoa, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And she said to, one, try again and, you know, look in the pen hip, which I did as well, and his hits came back, the ranges were average. So a puppy that I kept from his first litter, her hips are fantastic. I did pin hip on her, and they are well above, like, they're fantastic. I think the rating was like 0.38 and 0.40, and breed average is 0.54, I believe, for pin hip on Staffordshire Bull Terriers. So I've kind of changed my view on how I handle those kinds of issues when it comes to health testing. For things like cardiac and eyes, they oftentimes have clinic at shows. Like this last weekend at a dog show, it was like $30 for eyes to get the eyes checked and $40 for heart. That's two of the health testing out of the way for 70. Was it 70 bucks? Yeah, 40 and 30, 70 bucks. The genetic panel, you can get that for, at least for mine, you can get that for about 110. That takes care of like three of the listed health testing. The biggest expense is the hips and the elbows. But even then, you can find reasonable vets. I recently did hips and elbows on the sire of these puppies, and that cost me under $400. So I don't feel like the health testing should be used as a tool to charge more. I feel like how I charge for my puppies. Yeah, okay, health testing is part of it, but I charged as like basically what the market value is. And that sounds terrible as I say it, because people are like, oh, she's in it for the money. But no, I am putting money into these dogs, and it's not just health testing, okay? Because I can find health testing for fairly cheap. I've gotten to a point where I can, you know, pull it together fairly cheap. But I'm also still, you know, money spent in raising dogs, money spent in all the things that you need that goes into it, showing sports. And some will say, well, you know, you don't have to show a dog to, you know, you don't have to do sports. But to me, it's like, yeah, yes, in order to prove that the dog is worth, you know, worthy of being bred, yeah, that is something I need to do. And that is not that is not cheap, you know. It all adds up. As a whole, not just the one thing, not just, you know, it's not just the health testing that you can justify having high prices. It's the whole picture. It's everything. Because like, I think there are going to be times where you are going to take a risk health wise. There are situations where you're going to take a risk health wise. When I imported, my last one from Ukraine, parents were not health tested, but most breeders overseas do not do health testing. So that is a risk that I'm taking, but she, honestly, right now, she is my nicest Stafford. She literally, just like you said, ticked all the boxes. She's spectacular, and I can, you know, I'm just that, you know, when health testing comes, that, you know, everything will be okay. They were for Colt, overall, but there will be times where you might have to take some risk and then accept that if it does fail, you might be a pet. It might end up being just a pet, or might end up being, you know, a dog that you might place if you don't have the room, I guess you could say. Because when it comes to having a program, it gets to a point where you can only keep so many pets. If you're really, really, really wanting to improve your program and you're just like, this is what you want to do, there's only so many pets that you can keep. And I will tell you that in my breed and in many breeds, there are a lot of people who kind of disagree with this. And maybe I'm kind of going off on a tangent here, but I actually think it's really, really important.
No, go for it. I appreciate it.
So a lot like to keep awesome. A lot like to keep their animals for life, and I do get that. A lot think that it's cruel to get a dog and to raise it and then place it if it doesn't belong. And this kind of goes in with it. My second point, it kind of goes in with it. So I'm going to include it before I say my point. There's also a lot of people within my breed who disagree with breeding frequently. A lot of breeders like to only breed, every few years. I think I one breeder told me they bred three times in like 20 something years. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that for their if that's what they want to do in their program, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But I also don't think that there's anything wrong with a breeder who has a program where they do breed frequently. And I'm not talking about pumping out puppies to make money. Because you have to breed to have experience. You have to breed to figure out what works and what doesn't work. If you look at some of the dogs who are, top winning dogs, they typically come from breeders who have bred and who have experienced breeding and who have tried, who have like tried different things and to see what works for them and what doesn't work for them. I don't think there's anything wrong with breeding maybe a couple times a year. As long as each breeding has a goal to improve, each breeding has a goal in mind. And then of course the health testing, as a tool to help, and obviously backing up your puppies. I will always take my puppies back. My pets go on spay and neuter. Being responsible for your puppies that you produce, because you are responsible for every one. But when it comes to the number of litters you have a year, I don't think someone should be condemned for having several litters a year. And I have come across that in quite a bit. But yeah. Oh, so and that kind of goes back to, so if you get a puppy and it's promising, but the puppy it doesn't turn out. This happened to me recently. I got a she was a beautiful puppy. The pedigree was great. Both parents championed. And she ended up she had a elongated soft palate. She just had a couple of issues, and in the end, she just was not a dog that I thought should be bred. So I ended up getting the palate surgery done on her to kind of help free up her airways, and I spayed her. She was almost 2 years old, or at 2 years old, and I ended up sending her to a pet home. And a lot of people think that's cruel, but I don't, because she's gonna sit in my she's gonna be here, and she, yeah, she'll be a pet, and I love my dogs, but I have a goal, and I want to reach that goal, and I can only have so many dogs to reach that goal. And I do believe that it's unfair to her because I am going to be going to shows or sports, and I guess she could do sports, but I need room for my up and comers, and that may be controversial to some, but I don't agree with it. I think that there's nothing wrong with it when you have a goal, and if it's best for the dog. Now, I've only been breeding, for about 4 years, so I do consider myself a baby baby, into it, but I recently got to see some in our breed go to Westminster. They actually, I mean, not Westminster, Crufts. So they actually got to go to, overseas, and one of them even brought their dog and got to show in Crufts. I thought that was incredible. And inside I'm like, oh man, I wish I was at that point. And then I'm like, oh, I've only been breeding for 4 years. Like I can't expect that like instantly. I got to do the work. I just one I want to I want to I do try to have a goal for each litter. And I do have like a couple directions that I want to kind of work on and see kind of what fits. One of my biggest goals is to create my type, because there are dogs that I can look at and I know exactly what kennel that dog comes from. I know that dog is a Prizedale dog. That dog is an irresistible dog. And I think that's wonderful. I think it's fantastic. And that is what I want. Something that I want. I want consistency. But I'm still learning how things work. I'm learning how to kind of put the puzzles together when it comes to phenotype and genotype, pedigree, and how they look, and kind of how that all fits together. I just did my first line breeding. This litter I have now is my very, very first line breeding. I was very careful about it on who I doubled up on. And I actually have found that the litter is quite consistent. There's a little bit of differences in the heads, but the body types are very, very similar. And that's kind of what I want across the board. So I do want to continue to improve. Like I said, I pretty much spent these last 4 years trying to figure out what I feel is, well, one, to get over this whole height and weight thing and kind of accept that I'm probably not going to be able to conform to that exactly if I'm going to do okay in the show ring. I would like to companion. I want a dog that I can campaign. I think that would be awesome. I want to get there. I want to breed a dog that I am a bred by that I can campaign and go kind of as far as I can with them. An obvious goal would be, a Westminster invite. I know there's a lot of breeders out there who have gotten that, and that's kind of like a simple Westminster invite, and then maybe one day Westminster. But that's such a long, long way off. I feel it's unattainable, so I'm just gonna keep trucking. It can be a bit overwhelming. I sometimes feel, and maybe it's because I'm new, I sometimes feel, I guess, what do you call it? Like imposter syndrome, where it's like I don't feel like part of it. I am, I went through some hard times, so I have not shown as much as I want to, and I'm hoping this year that I'm going to pick it back up, as much as I was before, and then even more so. And luckily, I'm now in a place where I can do that. And I do have specific goals, like more specific goals as far as what I want for my overall look of the dog. I do have ideas with that I want to run with. It's fairly detailed stuff that's, but overall goal is just kind of work my way up, one step at a time, one show at a time.
Yeah, that's awesome. I like that answer. Talk about when you're going to keep a puppy. What are some of the things that you look for to be not only a good show prospect, but a good future breeding prospect?
So when I because I have a couple litters a year, and because I do, like as I mentioned about, there's only so many that a breeder can keep. I often utilize guardian homes. I think they are fantastic, or some people call them show friendly. I have some pretty nice Staffords in homes that have let me, or that have worked with me. Showing. I have. I In fact, I finished my first Guardian Home Dogs Championship a couple months ago. And that's been fantastic. I kind of say, because like I said, I talked about my different directions, you know, that I'm kind of going with and seeing what works and what doesn't. There are certain litters that, you know, I have plans that I had plans for, and it's like, that is one that I'm that puppy, you know, I'm keeping this puppy with me. Because it's there is always a risk using, there's always a risk bringing someone else in, you know, but keeping a puppy is kind of like the safest guarantee that you what you want is going to happen. So I do get a lot of help from my Amstaff breeder. I guess you could say she's my mentor. Every litter she does help me evaluate. But I start stacking my puppies at 4 weeks. And then I do weekly evaluations, basically until they are like 9 weeks. Around 7 to 8 weeks is kind of like the most important time. And then, you know, what in between that, you kind of just have to watch the dogs and how they move naturally, how they interact naturally, because you can have a dog that is gorgeous, but the temperament is just not there. First off, the breed is very soft, so trying to build a very soft Stafford, softer than usual Stafford up, can be very difficult. So sometimes having a dog that has that charisma, and you just kind of know when you see them, you know, just kind of strutting around, and just confidence is there, head is up, and you just know. But around 7 to 8 weeks, you know, I stack them up, I take videos and pictures and kind of evaluate them, and then I send them off to my mentor and a couple different people to try to get a collective idea of, you know, the good and the bad about each puppy, and go from, you know, kind of go from there. So temperament, structure, temperament, so important. So important when it comes to that, though.
Yeah, that's very cool that you do that. That's kind of the idea that I just as a layman would probably want to rely on is several eyes on what I'm looking at to see if I'm right or if I'm wrong. That's smart.
Yes, especially, and honestly, I feel like I'm always going to do that. Because, yeah, okay, you know, with more experience, I'm sure I'll get to a point where I just know that I know that I know. But I feel like a good way to prevent, I guess what they call kennel blindness. I think a good way to prevent kennel blindness would probably be to get, you know, idea to get others' ideas and opinions, and to see if they see something that you don't see.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I think, yeah, I mean, that's what being a part of the community should be, is being able to help each other, like, make the best decisions.
There are a couple breeders in California. There's like a kind of small group. They have puppy evaluation parties. They bring their litters together and they all evaluate each other's litters. And I think that's fantastic. I wish I lived in California at that time. We don't have any breeders down here to really do that, but I think that's wonderful. And I think that that would be great to become a normal thing across the board, you know. The biggest challenge was finding the type and kind of where I wanted to go. That I would say absolutely that is the biggest issue I had, and it took years to get through that, and kind of find where I finally have settled on where I want to go. And then it also took accepting the fact, it also took accepting that I was going to go in another direction as well to see if that works for me. Because I feel like if I had just gone one way, I would always wonder if about the about going the other way. And I guess it's kind of hard to explain it. But I have my dogs I have now, basically from my first boy, to his daughter, and now I now have a daughter from her. So basically the line that I've kind of established now, and then the import that I have from Ukraine, she's a kind of a totally different type, totally different line. That's kind of what I'm going to go for. Like, I'm also going to go forward with her kind of in a different way, and then maybe in the future see if they can kind of intertwine in some way. But right now I'm not really worried about that. I'm just gonna just go forward. But other things that I have issues with is well, one, I'm still learning structure. I mean, I think I got it. I'm pretty sure I got it down, but there are certain things that are difficult for me, like movement for me. Like, I still have to video movement, and I have to slow it down and watch it in slow motion. I know that movement is so important because it goes hand in hand with structure, and so I'm really, really trying to learn that. I would really like to be able to look at a dog in real time move and be like, oh wow, that's, you know, that's beautiful. And I'm getting there. All that takes is just time. It just takes time. But I'm working really hard on that. And then, you know, not just like the side movement, you know, their extension, their reach and extension, but their down and back. You know, Staffords, they're not really supposed to converge. Their legs are supposed to move parallel, both front and back. And honestly, it's kind of hard to find that kind of movement in Staffords. So that's been a struggle for me. And I'm just kind of trying to see how that fits in with, you know, if I have a puppy with nice structure, but it converges in the rear a little bit, you know, I gotta be willing to kind of see what I'm gonna sacrifice here when it comes to moving forward. There are other issues, like, I like the color blue, in Staffords, but there is kind of a big bias towards blues right now. You don't really see them in the ring. A lot of breeders don't want to deal with it. A lot of breeders look down on it. There's even a contradiction in our standard about it. Blues are completely acceptable in our breed standard, in our breed, but it also states that they have to have a black nose. Blue Staffords cannot have a black nose. It's genetically impossible. So, you know, that it seems so minor, but it can really, really throw things off. And then there's kind of some myths surrounding health issues. Some are true, some aren't. So, like I said, a lot of breeders don't want to deal with it. And I have been told many times that I should watch out what I show, including a blue dog. If I try to show a blue Stafford, I'm probably going to get flack. I'm probably going to get a lot of talk about it, and not in a good way. And so I actually had my first litter with blue a little while ago, and I have one that will be kind of up and coming in the ring, and I'm a little nervous. I'm excited, but I'm nervous about it. You know, it's kind of like, I don't want to ruin my reputation, but I also feel like I'm not really doing anything that is wrong, you know, because it's acceptable color. I think a lot of people's concern might be that I'm trying to be a color breeder, and when the fact is I'm absolutely not. I enjoy that color, and I feel like a nice blue should be able to be shown and championed. And there are some breeders out there that have had blues and have championed them, but it's just so very rare. It just doesn't happen often. So I kind of just want to make it more of a normal thing. Just kind of more normalized. More normalized, basically. And another, probably the last struggle, I guess, would be learning lines and pedigree. And I'm sure that's with everybody, but that's just it's a lot of information. It's a lot to learn, and you just really have to be, your whole heart and soul has to be into it to just learn it all. But I think it's important to utilize history to kind of work towards the future.
So if there's something that you could change about the show world, what would it be?
I wish that, I'm not even going to go into the politics. Some have denied that there are politics, but there are definitely politics involved. I feel like the actual show world is the system we have set up. I think it's fantastic. I think it's a great system, but it kind of just, as we as humans just tend to mess up things. We come up with great ideas, and we just kind of like money gets involved, and we just mess up things. But that's it is what it is. But I do wish that people were more open to newcomers. I wish people were a little more friendly overall. It is a competition. I get that. But in the end, we all have the same goal. And when it comes to new people, I mean, we need people who love the breed. We need people in here trying to do better by the breed. And so I just think that being a little more welcoming would it, you know, it just would make all the difference in the world. I find it frustrating when there, I mean, obviously losing isn't fun, but everybody loses. Everybody loses, and everybody has their day. And I feel like accepting your losses and celebrating your wins is, you know, I think that just all just comes with it. I've seen, it's different being in the show world than when you were, than like before, when you're on the outside looking in. You know, in my head, it was always like, you know, I can only breed if I champion a dog. And, you know, people who, everybody who shows is ethical. And it's kind of, you know, stuff like, it's kind of not really how it is. Not everybody who shows is ethical. And honestly, not every dog who champions, you know, or who doesn't champion shouldn't be bred either. Sometimes there's good dogs that just don't do well in the ring, but have to, like, really, they have, I've been told that some of the best dogs have never stepped foot in the ring. I've been told that by a couple different people with a lot of experience, and I can see that, and I can, now I can see that and understand and kind of understand it. I also wish that breeders, I wish that we could all like get together, like sit ringside, and be able to discuss our dog's faults and not get offended with it, about it. I think that that would be so beneficial. You know, I think that would be beneficial as a whole to be able to discuss your faults and with other people, and kind of like I learned from it, you know. I really could have used that when I was trying to learn structure, because I was just trying to like look at every dog and look at, okay, what is the good and what is the bad. But I could not go up to that owner and be like, hey, could you tell me what the, you know, what you like about your dog and what you don't like about your dog? Could you tell me what you could improve on your dog? That does not fly. You can't do that. And I feel like we should be able to without getting offended.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. But I also know myself. So that would be something that I would have to be really conscious of, not to let my emotions get in the way, especially if I didn't like that other person that was critiquing my dogs.
I was to say, the thing is that in AKC, we don't get, the judges don't really tell you why they didn't put up your dog. So you're not really getting any feedback. You can ask them, but a lot of times they're so busy that by the time you get back to them, they may not even remember, you know? And I feel like because of that, we should be able to talk to others. And like, okay, yeah, it can kind of be hurtful to hear the negatives about your dog, but it also helps how you approach, you know, how, like, if a person's coming at you and being like, "Oh, your dog's rear is really bad." No. That's just the wrong. There's a right and a wrong way to approach it, you know, that you can have some tact talking about, you know, your dog's fault. And I'm not saying like you should go up to somebody and be like, "Hey, your dog is whatever." I feel like people should come up to, you know, should come up to each other and they have their dogs and be, and you could be like, "This is what I think, you know, this is what I like about my dog, but I wish she had a better top line. I wish she had better ears. You know, I feel like her rear could improve." You know, and then be able to talk, like, y'all should both be able to discuss dogs without anybody being getting offended, because everybody's goal is to fix, is to fix the, no dog is perfect, and the goal is to fix those flaws. And who knows, being able to talk about it might, you know, might be beneficial. That person might be like, "Oh, you know, I know, you know, my friend has this male that has a fantastic top line and good re everything that you are wanting. You know, would you like to get, you know, I could, maybe I could help you." It just, I feel like that would just be beneficial as a whole.